Greetings, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Way of the Showman, where we, as always, view the world through the lens of showmanship. I am Captain Frodo, and I will be your host and your guide along the way. This episode, I am back doing a Skype call from Las Vegas to Stockholm, talking to my good friend and fellow podcast host, Jay Gilligan, and he asks me questions again that he has pulled off the episode using some fancy AI overlord snippet cutting thing. I was just thinking we were going to jump straight into that because it's quite a long one. We end, as you can see, more than almost 2 hours. And the only thing that I wanted to comment on was that in the heat of the moment, I confused two people. When we, towards the end of the episode, start talking about the imaginal realm, that is correctly the thinking of Henri Corbin, an Islamic scholar and everything. But I, in the preamble to this, I describe a course, a lecture course that I did. But that is actually with Henri Bergson. That's so although everything that I say in about Corbin is what Corbin said, I am confusing him a little bit there with Bergson. And I'll post a little link for those people who want to listen to 23 hours of summary on the on the philosophy of Henri Bergson, which is also a tremendously interesting philosopher, but he does not, as far as I know anyway, talk about the imaginal realm. So, with that confusion cleared up, as much as it might be just making it more nebulous, as I have not started talking about it yet, let's just jump into the world of ideas and let Jay ask me questions about the second part, the second episode in the play and showmanship series called The Inner Earbone of Showmanship, and it is the 95th episode. So we're talking about that and exploring it here. So let's jump into the world of play.
Should we jump into episode 2 of the current season?
Let's jump into episode 2 of Play and Showmanship and Play.
So I'll just read the snip, and then I have my little comment and my question, kind of this format.
Awesome. what I thought as well was that I hadn't sort of said, but if there are any of the people who are listening, such as yourself, and you're thinking that you would do you actually have any questions, then, you know, maybe the easiest way is to go to Instagram, The Way of the Showman at Instagram, and just send a message, or you can send it at the way of the showman at gmail.com. If there are anyone else who has any specific questions or comments about these episodes.
That's awesome. So I'm going to warn you, my question is a little bit of a tangent to what you say here, but it's you'll see. So you said, and before we can talk about how that material is to be speaking, you said it much better than that, Frodo. So I try again. And before we can talk about how that material is to be presented, I think that the act of showmanship necessitates that human beings are arranged in a certain relationship. That's it. That's the whole snip.
Yeah.
And the thing that brought to my mind immediately when I heard that was the Danny D. Ortiz quote, which I'm sure we talked about before, which is they asked, hey, what's the best method you have to fool someone with your cards? And they wanted an answer like a special double lift or a bottom deal or something. And Danny D. Ortiz said, the best technique, the best method to fool someone is to arrange the chairs in a certain pattern so that the entire audience can see the double lift. Mm. And it, because it can be the most genius double lift in the world, but if the person sitting next to you misses that move, then there's it just destroys the flow of events.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, so this is this that, so your quote just, you know, instantly reminded me of that idea.
Yeah.
About like physically arranging, you know, the people, the human beings are arranged in a certain relationship. But the reason I love this quote from you so much, and I wanted to ask you more about it, is this is another aspect of performing that I think most of us, including me, take for granted, like most of the time, right? So when we think about doing a show, we think about, oh, what music are we going to use? And maybe even how loud should the music be? And what's our costume? And what's the lights? We go into a lot of detail about what we're doing. It's not a trivial task, but we do. There are, of course, many things that we just have to take for granted. And one of those things is that, like, yep, there'll be an audience and they're going to be more or less paying attention in this certain way. Like, there's going to be chairs for them to sit in, I guess. I mean, I know there's ways we can play with this format. There's the whole immersive theater thing where it's you know, walking around a space. I get it that we often, as artists, we think about how is the audience going to sit and what is the physicality of the venue. But just in general, I don't want to talk on that level of detail, but zoom out a conceptual step up. And you're talking about arranging human beings in a relationship. That's so much cooler, Frodo, than being like, where's the audience going to be? Because arranging human beings in a relationship, in a certain relationship, it means you're one of them and they are one of you. And there's just so many more options that open up in my mind. Like when I perform with Eric, we like keeping the house lights on because in our style of performance that we do specifically to our partnership together, we want to be in the same room as the audience. We all want to be in the same room. We don't want to separate ourselves. We don't want to have a hierarchy that, like, there's the audience that's passive and there's the performer that's active, right? And so that's also another example of this idea of thinking like, hey, we're a bunch of human beings and we're arranged in a certain relationship. And to drill down that far down into the fundamentals of your performance craft is pretty rare. So can you talk about how you deal with this relationship and this arrangement, and how did you come across this basically, and how do you deal with it?
Yeah, so in the next episode that comes out, now I don't know when this one is going to come out, but it's this might actually come out, so it might be in the previous episode that comes out, I talk again about what showmanship is. And this showmanship that I see, that this has to do with, because I'm trying to look at it at the most, exactly that what you say, at the most fundamental level, and try to get beyond it. In shorthand, it's also that I have done many different things. I've fully identified as a magician when I was young. Then I fully identified as a circus, or specifically a juggler, for a long time. And then I identified as a freak show performer, and then eventually those things went into, let's just say, then I started to go, what is it that I do? And also when I help people, when we did La Clique or La Soirée, and I was talking to people about how they could fit their act into the show, I talked to dance to singers, or talked to whip cracking act, or talked to all these different things. And I had to have something to say to everyone. So I need to develop a language that was interdisciplinary, so that the stuff that I had thought and my approach to talking to all of these different artists made sense. Even though I don't know so much about the details of doing a stack of rollerballers up high or whatever, but what I did know was about the relationship that particular show had, and in with La Clique or La Soirée, and that the relationship that I have would like to have with my audience. And that really was what got me into this understanding. The fundamentals is, so that's one thing. The second thing is that this, when I'm specifically talking about that we have to be in a relationship, it's actually working on several different levels or whatever. And one of the first things, and this comes from this that I talk about in the Showman's Manifesto, that a showman is someone who faces the other way. And I when I
wrote that and sort of stumbled on that. And I wrote this kind of poem or whatever that I read aloud in an episode that I can't remember the number of. But that is now that I'm doing the rewrite of season two, the mess and stuff that comes there. This poem is the red thread of part one. It takes you through the whole, my sort of philosophy of showmanship can be told through this poem. And the line that maybe that caught my attention was that I'd written was this thing of a showman is someone who faces the other way, where I haven't couldn't find anything more sort of fundamental in what that was. And the archetypal picture is that it's just of the formation of one facing a group of others.
Mm.
Like when everyone is sitting around a fire, it can be in a half circle or whatever, in the cave, in my mind, I'm like, oh, that's always the most ancient thing. And I know Eric also does this, goes back, and I often then go back to what I think of as the cave in my mind of like, everyone's around a fire, and then somebody stands up, and the others arrange themselves subtly or so to pay attention to the one person standing up and facing a group. So that's one of the things where I thought that's what happens in most shows. When you say you and Eric goes out, most of the time, that's what happens. If it's in a theater, they have sort of forced the natural shape of the audience is more like a circle or like an ellipse, where you are in the center of something and people are sitting at a sort of equidistant from you. Whereas a circle or like more as an ellipse if you're out with it, if it's a really big and it's a full circle and you're outside and you have to look at the back. But so the main thing I think of is almost like a crescent moon or whatever, where there's like some people are sitting sort of on the back a little bit, but there's less there because it's not quite as good. They watch your bum more. Like in Mad Apple, it's a bit like that. It's a bunch of people who are sitting sort of in the back, but then at the front is where the most people are. So to me, that forms a kind of crescent moon, and then you have the performer in the sort of center, back center of that to look at everyone. So that's one level of it. It's the actual physical organization, and that's what you talk about when it's like the difference between an immersive show or like, okay, we're going to have one stage out in the audience, or we go, it's like I'm thinking of doing the show at the theater at home, and there is a walkway that goes through at the top, and there's a big section of those people. So if you have a sold-out show, which I hope that it's going to be, then I feel like I need to do something there so that those last 150 people, that there's at least one act or something that happens there, so that it's a little bit cumbersome to see for the people who are closer. So that's like one level of just thinking of it, of you have to be aware of your relationship to them. And it starts in that most fundamental way of two people facing each other. Like, but it's rare, even though you do get it, that's a rare situation that it's two people facing each other. It's actually one facing a group. So that's the
and even just to say, I mean, that facing each other, it's conceptual. Like, we don't physically need to be facing. We just need to establish the relationship. That's what's exciting to me.
Yes.
Is that it's a relationship. It's not a specific, concrete, you know, locked in exactly like this, you know.
When it's in general, people say, like with theater or whatever, so you shouldn't turn your back on the audience. But I turn my back on the audience a lot, but I never turn my back on them so that they think that I have forgotten about them.
Right.
Or that it's just that I allow myself all forms of movement and positions and whatever on the stage. I'm falling around, so I'm doing all this. But I never let them forget that I am here only for them. So that's the other relationship. Why am I on stage here now? And I have my motives of I would like to do this act, or I would like to, I have a new idea that I want to present. But the real reason for why I am out there, it's for them to get experiences. And Kjartu talked a little bit about this yesterday at the Golden Brick, but yeah. I was like, she was saying there needs to be some sort of structure or story, like how is what we do going to be perceived by the audience? And someone had sort of commented going, oh, you can just do whatever you want. It doesn't have to hang together. You just do things and then you do something else. And then we're in that territory that you and me have explored at length when we've been talking about intentions, and we talk with Eva and you and me and abstract versus concrete. And I think that just nailed down a little golden peg in that thing of, okay, we It has to do with that. How do you expect your thing to be perceived by the audience? And if it really is, I just came up with this movement, or I came up with this thing, and I'm going to do it, and you deal with it. If it means something, it's up to you. If not, I don't care, because I just want to do it. And that attitude is totally valid for those who want to explore that. But to me, that smells a little bit of sort of solipsism, that you go, I just make stuff, and then it just is valuable just because it exists, and then you can deal with it as you want. I am particularly interested in structure and in keeping the audience in mind all the way through, because as I see it, then if the structure is the audience showman relationship, this is the foundation of what showmanship is, what performance to me is. It's the encounter between one and usually the many. It's the many, but it's the many as one. It's sort of like we have a group thing, right? Dynamic. And that relationship, shaping that, that's sort of at the core of it. So if you come out there and you could do your thing exactly the same, just in the dark or in your room, then you're missing out on what I think is the most exciting dimension about performance, which is doing the relationship with the audience. And I go one further, perhaps, on there, where I'm going, when I am only fully a showman, I'm only fully a performer, when I stand in front of an audience and they are watching me and this relationship is alive. If I am just standing in my room, magic room at home practicing, that isn't, I'm still preparing to be a showman. And that's the inner aspect of it. If you divide it up into the show, and then you have the man, or the man as in human, the human being, then that's me at home preparing to do the show. But that thing only comes alive and only is a real thing, just like you can prepare yourself for a dialogue with someone or a conversation. But until that other person is there, it isn't actually a conversation. So with that, not only is it that I go out and I am there for them, I am there, and I, when I turn my back on them, I still have them in mind, and I am just quickly getting something or doing something like you are in real life. But it's not just that I am there for them, but it is that I cannot be myself fully as a showman unless I have them. And this just became so apparent to me when I wrote this stuff during the pandemic as well, because then I didn't have them. And I was preparing all sorts, and I was hoping that I was going to get to go back to them. But you realize that I, not only am I not all of these completely useless skills that I have of balancing and whatever, if there aren't other people there, those things feel completely unfulfilled. And on top of it, I can't support my family anymore. So that relationship too is gone. So you sort of see this really direct thing where I am now, if I don't have that kind of relationship with them, and they, then I am not who I am. And there was one more dimension to it as well that I can't, that slipped my mind a little bit. Well, now
you already touched on it there a little bit ago, where I think the fascinating thing in the moment of this episode we're talking about, when this quote comes along and it's like, the act of showmanship necessitates that human beings are arranged in a certain relationship. The converse thing of that, which again, you pointed out, it means that you have an intention of what you want the experience to end up being, meaning that you have an idea of what the effect of what you're doing will accomplish. Yeah. And speaking, like you said, me and you have spoken about this a lot, about abstract and concrete and all these things. But speaking as a person who's a juggler, and juggling is an abstract art form. It's abstract. It's really hard for juggling to have a narrative like a magic trick. You know, here's the egg is gone, and now the egg is back. That's a pretty linear narrative. Mm-hmm. Where it's like with juggling, it's like, unless the narrative is like, I have 5 rings, I'm not going to drop them. Oh, now I got 6 rings. Let's see if I drop them this time. Nope, I didn't. Here's 7 rings. I hope I don't drop them. Like, that's basically the linear narrative of juggling. I'm sure we can find some others. Or it's like I'm juggling a chainsaw and I hope I don't cut my hand off. Like, we can have linear or concrete narratives, let's say. But for the most part, if we're not dealing with the skill, difficulty, and risk, it's just like, hey, here's this juggling pattern or this series of movements or choreography. And, you know, what does it exactly mean? Or what are you going to get out of it? I can't, you know, it's abstract. But at the same time, just because it's abstract, that doesn't mean you can't have some sort of specific ambition of why you're showing it to someone. And so that's why I love it that, like, again, this idea that, like, going down to the fundamentals of we are arranged in a relationship here, that already starts to give that foundation that you have something that you want to say, and you care about it so deeply that you even acknowledge the most fundamental part of the show, which is the relationship between the performer and the audience. And so, yeah, so for me, it was this, it was like a light in the dark, or like it was shining a light on this other thing farther away down the line of making a performance, where it's like, hey, not only is the performer and the audience in a relationship, and everybody goes, yeah, obviously, duh, like that's that's so obvious, but hold on now, that care to detail and attention and intention, you know, down the line isn't so obvious later on. Like I said, again, if you're going to do juggling for some sort of visual or like, you know, contemporary dance or some sort of abstract movements, it's much harder than to talk about it. So it's kind of fun to go to work your way backwards to the start, where you can talk very plainly and simply about these things and start to care about them and have them in your mind, so that later on when it gets a little bit more difficult, you know, you have an anchor at least of like what you're doing. I thought that was really cool. Go ahead.
I think that's really good. That is what this is. It's to this is particularly what season two was about, which is currently what I'm rewriting at the moment. So that's to understand showmanship, or understand what it is that we do on the really low, primitive, or fundamental level. And doing that means that if you have that in the bottom of as a foundation for what it is that you do, these things will permeate through all of your work. And juggling, as all of the other performances, things that we can do and show people, is ultimately, in terms of the relationship with the audience, it's an experience for the audience. That the art that we do is not so, it's something that they naturally understand linearly through time. And like Goethe was talking about, it doesn't have to be a concrete thing that you want to say. She was doing a show that is quite political, so she was using that word a lot. Like, it doesn't have to be a political thought. But for me, it doesn't have to be that it expresses something specifically biographical about you as a person. Or it might not need to be specifically about any philosophical aspect or whatever. But to keep the experience in mind for them, and to have a goal for what you want that experience to be at the end. So you want to make structure also just means, how do you divide your act up? So you're doing the five balls and you're doing the six balls, as you said, or rings, and then you're going to juggle the chainsaw, and you want to make sure that these are at different points in the show, and you instigate then the game or the whatever that thing is, like where you in the beginning you don't drop, and then the first time you drop, you have the possibility now to play with what drop means and whatever. So then you have that thought into the show that, okay, I'm doing this, but then, and then when that happens, then comes this bit that deals with the fact of dropping, which is when you say, you immediately start to go, what's a throw, what's a catch, what does the drop mean? And those are themes that naturally comes up in the, in quotation marks, story of juggling, like the relationship that you have with the audience. If you juggle a whole lot and don't drop, then they go, oh, wow, we understand what this is. But then all of a sudden, the ball can drop, and you have explored in many of your shows. It's like not just like, oh, this gust of gravity, and you pick it up again. But you have explored all the stuff that can actually happen on the floor, from rolling the flashlights, and that I remember from the first show I saw of yours in like 2002 or something, when that's in Sweden there. And I was like, because I've rolled clubs on the floor, but I hadn't seen this, like the idea of doing that with a light and how the light cast. Anyway, then so those things are stuff, like it can still be abstract things, but you can deal with them and deal with them in different ways. And it's the key thing is just to have the what is the experience for the audience, because this might, and this comes down to this thing that I'm going, okay, well, the relationship is important, and then the audience is expected to be able to pay attention. So we need to make it sort of nice for them to pay attention. If you make it really difficult to pay attention, that you don't do anything like minimalism or whatever, then in circus people don't expect that you're gonna do a juggling show and all you're gonna do is to throw three balls three times over the hour. If that is what you do, then you're down to a very niche, you're in sort of John Cage territory or whatever, where you and that's also okay, but that's not what people expect. So usually there's going to be more to it than that. All right, I lost my thread in there.
No, you're good. Let's wrap up this snip with a little extra quote from it. It will tie up everything we said, and I'm super excited about the next one. But to finish this up, you had a couple of nice things here that really fit. It will wrap it up. It says, there needs to be at least one showman, someone who has something to show and that can get the attention. And there needs to be someone watching, which will be the audience. And I think this structure is more fundamental than how it is to be, than how it is that what you're doing is going to be presented. And that goes back to the Danny D'Ortiz thing perfectly. So the guy's asking him, hey, what is the thing that's to be presented? What is your best method? Yeah. And Danny's like, no, the method is that people see, they can see what I do. And so that's the structure that's more fundamental than how it is, what you're going to present. So I think that's really fitting. I like that idea that it's more fundamental. And again, going back to this idea that that's not something we normally talk about. So I wanted to highlight that in my mind here.
Yeah, it's a great point. Absolutely. Everybody's got to see, and that becomes before you do any method. In the middle, and that he's a magician, Danny D'Ortiz is a magician, and the magician are asking for magic methods, and he is talking on what I feel like on the level of showmanship. He talks one level deeper because of Tamariz and because of Ascanio and his sort of big teachers or whatever, Lennox Green and David Williamson, who is his big influences. But
well, it's like someone asking me like, hey, so you have a new show. What do you do? And oh yeah, I'm juggling in the show. Oh, how do you do that? Or what's the show like? We never in our normal everyday language say, well, get this. The show starts off and there's an audience, right?
Yeah.
Who's not me. And I'm not part of the audience. I'm a performer and they're watching what I do and I'm giving them an experience. Like we never start the conversation from there. And I get it. Like why we don't do that in everyday casual life. But I think as an artist in the or whatever you want to say to, as a showman, right, in the rehearsal room, in the creation room, I think it is dangerous to skip over these conversations we could be having. I mean, I think it's great that you start from that point and you don't just assume that that's happening. It's perfect.
Yeah. And it's also like, because what I feel like is as soon as I was working with the TJ here on the new act that he has, or when you and me are working on the show, then we immediately start getting into the details. Will I stand here? Will I stand there? Will I say this? Will I say that? Will I go? Whenever I'm going to make an actual act or have a collaboration with someone or help someone directing someone or be co-creating an event, an act or whatever, a show, then it becomes all about the details. But those become that's sort of secondary, because if you can clarify what it is that you want the experience to be like for the audience, what the experience is for you, not just I have a couple of things there, because then people can throw at me, which sometimes happens. People go, maybe this thing, maybe that thing, I could do this thing, I could do that thing, maybe I could juggle this, I could do this, I could swallow a sword, I could do, and then I go, well, like, I don't know what all of these things are. And before we start to just puzzle things next to each other, if we have an overarching idea of where we're going and what the aim is for what do you want to achieve in this, because you're one of the players in this game of the, and what do you want it to be for the audience, how do you want it to be developed and everything, their experience so that they sit at the end, what they want to be left with something. What's the sum of this? And if you have some specific ideas of what it is that you want to explore, then that would help us ordering the structure of it, of what comes once before the other, what kind of music we need to use, what the staging will be, will all be guided by the fact that you know sort of what the ultimate experience for the audience is going to be. And if it really turns out there that, no, I don't like to do the same thing twice, I'm just going to improvise and I'm going to do it, and it turns out that it is mainly sort of about you, then that is also okay. And then you can frame it like that, and then the audience can come in knowing that this is this kind of performance, and therefore being able to not be alienated by expecting something else.
I just want to point out one thing. Like, I think about my younger self a lot when we have conversations, Frodo. I never told you this, but I think about myself when I was much younger, maybe a teenager or in my 20s. And I think about some of the stuff we're talking about, and it's that we are at our time of our lives that we're in right now, that we can have these reflections on our craft and on our careers, right? And so I often think about my younger self, if back then I had heard what we're talking about now, I think I often would be confused. And then I try to like make a solution to that in my mind of what I would tell my younger self, like some advice, you know? And so, now it's like, the thing just occurred to me in this little fictional scenario where it's like, you should have some sort of idea about what the experience is going to be for the audience. That's going to help drive the creation forward. But I can totally see my younger self saying, well, I don't know, Frodo. I don't know what the experience is. I juggle the rings like this. I throw the balls like this, and I flip the clubs like that. And I don't know how in the world should I know what the effect is going to be?
Yeah.
But then it occurs to me now, the advice I would give my younger self or to anybody who's wrestling with that question, because I hear people say that a lot. You know, they're like, I don't know what it's supposed to mean. I don't know what it's supposed to say or what it's supposed to look like, or I don't know what the audience will feel when they see this. It's like, I think a good place to start with that is just to notice what you feel and what you experience when you watch someone else. So yeah. Go to a show, see a show, and then just don't just take it in a casual way and go, oh, it was good, or oh, it was bad, or I was tired, or whatever, or it was hard to find the parking, my car, like a space to park my car before the show. I see lots of show reviews like that, you know, it's like a show review, yeah. And someone's like, really bad parking, you know, and you're like, okay, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. So in that way, though, go and watch a show and pay attention that when you see someone doing maybe the similar discipline as what you do or whatever, right? How do you feel? How does it make you feel? What kind of experience did you have? I think if you have to start having a critical eye towards yourself in the audience, and that will definitely help guide you, give the audience an experience when it's your turn to be up on stage, you, right? Like that's a...
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's the method.
And it's really great that you bring up this idea of how to present this to different people, because we are in a particular part of our lives and we've been in the business for a long time. So you start thinking on a grander scale. And that's why I'm saying when you go to a school, or as you are meeting the people who become mentors in your life, what's happening when you meet a good mentor, somebody that you trust, is that that person will point to things that you don't yet understand. And that's what's so interesting, why I read a lot of magic, is because there are a lot of people within magic, maybe not a lot, the majority of it's just tricks. Hold the deck like this, show the card like this, or when they give you the coin, then put it in your right hand and go, and so much of it is just like that. It's the detail. Yeah. But this is what I think of the Buddhists call the 10,000 things, and it confuses you. There's just, everything is going on everywhere all the time. Mm. And then you go, yeah, and then it's difficult to know what to say or what to think about anything, because everything is happening everywhere all the time. But when you then start to look at what it is and you take a standpoint for yourself, I am the one who faces the other way. That means my relationship to the world now starts to fall into place as well. As I read the book, as I practice my skill, I am aware that for this to make meaning, I need to be able to present it to someone else. And if what I have to present to other people is of no value to them, if it doesn't keep their attention, then if it's difficult or if it's uninteresting or whatever, then what I have to show does not have that immediate value. And if you're writing music, then this can turn out to have value in the future. If you are making a movie that's misunderstood now, it could turn out to be one of the great movies of all time later. But if you're doing live performance, then it is harder for that thing to remain. Then you got to write things down, or you got to make movies, and then you're already in a slightly different relationship to your audience anyway, if you're going to make performance videos or whatever. So the sheer kind of depth of or the importance of what we do, the actual activity of it, it means that we're going to need to pay attention to it. And yeah, and what is it that's on, and I talk about this often as well, on when you go, because one is the relationship, we have to be like this, but what is it that happens in that moment when I'm standing facing the other way and the audience is facing this way? Then they pay attention to me, and they give me their attention for a period of time. As they sit in front of me for 1 hour, I have prepared something that's going to be shown, and they pay attention to it. And that means that what my role in that is if the audience is there, then I have to curate the time and attention that they give me. So I have to decide what to do with the time and attention that they give to me for a specific time. So for 1 hour, they give it to me, and then I got to shape that and go, and all that this then becomes, it's like to think of a way to structure the material that I am presenting. And in that, those, that just that last sentence, that has in them then what I think is the anatomy of what an act is, or what that encounter is. It has those three elements. There's a lot more to it, but it's, somebody has to do it. The showman facing the other way, and they have to show you something, which is your material. It's the juggling. The material is usually something which is, it's an action. It's something that you do. It's not something that you stand on stage and think. Even if there are extreme cases of Bhutto where nothing is happening, but a lot is going on internally. That's an edge case, and then. Those things need to be organized in some sort of structure. So if you have character, structure, and material. Okay, hang on. I'm just going to have to say take a really quick break, because I think Saskia has gone to bed here.
Go for it.
I just texted and said what was going on here, and that. Okay, good. So I think that's kind of, and it, so. Back to the question at hand, or whatever, that got a bit philosophical again. And this is my tendency to go quite philosophical. And this is what the conversation with you helped me pull me down to earth. And your question is, what would this advice mean to the younger me, who I too was like, went into circus school. And one of the goals that I had, well, I went to circus school for 3 months at a course in 1996. So I can't say my experience is so big, you know, a lot, but I came in and I was like going, okay, well, I think I want to be able to do consistently 240 throws with my five balls. I want to have a club juggling act to music, and I want to learn a bit of trapeze, whatever. Like, I had these goals that were just like so kind of short-sighted, or just all stuff that what you've talked about before. Like, I come in and I go, what I basically needed was 2 to 3 months in the gym just making these things, but that I could have done somewhere else. Right. That's the big transformation that happened, was that I went in there and saw these other jugglers who were working on their seven clubs, and I was working on my five balls, and I realized, I don't think I'm going to spend 2 more years in the gym to get to that level, and that's what's going to be. And I realized in the performance classes with Bim Mason there, that this is where I am really coming alive, in the improvisation and in the being in front of an audience and present. Like, and I felt, I went to that circus course as a juggler, and left at least in my mind going like, I am a performer, as I thought of it then, like it's this, that's what I do or whatever. So, and then to that thing of going, I think it's that a good teacher or a good elder or a good mentor, as they often call it in magic, it's like they call it, like, he was one of my mentors. And it's just people that you had a on and off sometimes relationship or whatever. It's not like that you sat there and waited for them to get up in the morning or whatever, but like whenever I saw them there, they would talk to you specifically about your art and your craft. So And that's what I think this is then the potential of, because I see sometimes some of the people who are doing something and they do, and then all of a sudden they see and hear me talk, for instance, like I'm talking to people here in Vegas who listen to the podcast and go, you can get straight into that conversation. And I go, wow, amazing that somebody who now is 23 years old or 26 years old, that they are already now taking important steps on the way that it took me a long time to get to. And before that, I was performing a lot and I was dedicated and everything, but I was doing stuff much more short-sighted or whatever. And what listening to someone who has thought about these things before and taking some of the, because most of it will just wash off like water on a duck's back on people, but little snippets will, people will grab onto it. And this thing with the facing the other way and what that does to you and the relationship that you have with the audience and all these different aspects of it, that you are nothing without them, that humbleness that comes out of that. And from that also, the love that you need to have for the audience, which I now find beautifully reflected in Notes from a Fellow Traveler by Darren Brown. One of the things that he talks about, this thing of literally using like positive affirmation kind of style, talking to yourself in the mirror and going and standing and preparing. And in one of my early episodes, when I'm talking about in episode season 2, I talk about this as well. Doing the clique, standing at the hippodrome behind the curtains and just becoming aware of that we were hit in the West End. We were supposed to be here for whatever it was, 4 weeks, 6 weeks. And we are now in our sixth month and it just keeps being extended and people keep coming and we won an award, and that they are making this happen. Because I've been doing this all my life, but the relationship that's going on here now with this group of people and all that, this is something special. And these people are what's making it. The fact that there's like 600 people every night coming to the theater, or whatever, however many people there was could fit in that theater. So yeah, that's a long-winded way of doing it, but it's good to bring it down and think what would a 20-year-old that just wants to work on his technique or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, these things can get really conceptual and big and lofty, and they can sound mysterious and either unobtainable or irrelevant. But my point is, like, I always just think it's super accessible. It's not like we can talk very conceptually, but at the end of the day, these things aren't impossible, and they're it's very, in fact, a lot of it's just very easy, just coming down to those ideas of just paying attention and whatever else.
And it's also, what's important here is that the detailed talk about technique that happens in the actual encounter when you're standing there in the gym or whatever, or when you're practicing, and there is a time and a place for all of that. And those books, the books that I bought on juggling, the Encyclopedia of Ball Juggling or the Juggling with Finesse or whatever it was that I was reading back then, where a lot of that is on technique. Just like magic books, a lot of it is about technique. And I am liking when people write on the biggest zoom a little bit out right. And this is so, and it was wonderful to read. I've just started reading Ascanio's book on magic. Don't have to go into details about that, but he just said, and I was the kind of guy that I always liked to read the theory of the magic, and I always liked to read the forewords and the introductions, and I'm like, oh, that's what I do. I get in there, and it's a whole thing in magic. Guy Hollingworth famously put one of his best effects in his drawing room deceptions book. He weaves one of his coolest tricks into the introduction of the book in a way, so that to sort of hide it for all those people who are not like, he is also one of those people who like to read.
They just flip to the secrets and they skip the intro and then they miss the best trick. Yeah.
Yeah, and then that's going, so what is the shaman, where is the shaman adding? Well, it is this dimension here. And I am taking a leaf out of what so many people talk about, but that Austin Kleon talks about it in Steal Like an Artist. You're going, you have to write the book that you want to read. And this is a book that's out there or whatever. And these are the ideas that I don't readily hear. But when I'm now just borrowed some books of Nick, and it's Eugene Berger's book on spirit theater, he says in beautifully short, terse language the core tenets of what I'm talking about here. He expresses it differently, just like you and me use different language to express these different things. But we're on a wavelength, and we're sharing that with all these other theorists who have it, or whether it talks about the creation of a magical atmosphere, which is sort of what Ascanio talks about, where I'm talking about the area of interest that emerges between two people, which is what comes out in that next sort of, in this episode that I think was last week.
Yeah.
So,
well, we're having such a nice conversation here. So, but you have to get ready now, Frodo. You're going to have to work a little bit.
Good.
Because this next snip, you're really going to have to explain this to me, because I think it's crazy. And here we go. So here's the snippet, and I'm really eager to hear what you say about it. So the snippet is, the poem is a multitude of meanings, and it will manifest itself differently in each of the listeners. Yet there is not one in the crowd who grasps the quote real truth, and another which grasps a truth which is wrong. Each one of the ways that the poem manifests itself in each of the people that are listening to it, they're all true. And the way each listener connects to their own, on their own, to the poem, blah, 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 blah. The poem is all those things. It's all those things to everyone. You know, each person has their own way to experience it. It's all those things. And regardless of the size of the crowd, the poem will, in its subtleties and implicit meanings, be more than the sum of all those experienced truths. So we have two things here I want to get into.
Yeah.
The first thing is this idea, because we just had a long conversation now about what do things mean, like what do you want them to mean, what's the experience that people are having, right? And now this directly gets into that. So it says, you know, you're going to do something, and the way that people experience what you do for each person is going to be different, but it's not going to be right for one person and wrong for another. They're all going to be equally valid. That's the first thing I would love for you to expand upon, or again, comment on your relationship to that or how you deal with that in your work. And then the second thing is that because of that phenomena or whatever, then the poem, because it has all those multitudes of meanings, it will be more than the sum of all those experienced truths.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so hardcore. So
yeah.
Well, preach it to me, brother.
Okay, so brothers and sisters, I have wonderful news. When I present something, I try to be as clear as I possibly can in saying it. But in being clear about something, when you're presenting it on stage, the way that people connect to things most deeply is if they can sort of live themselves into it, or it relates to them. So if I become extremely specific about my thing and gives a whole lot of details, and I constantly say, it's not this, it's not that, it's not this, it's not that, and you narrow it down to something, when you narrow that all the way perfectly down so that there's no, then you are in the territory of manuals that explains how to use something or how to do one specific thing. When you change the oil, you unscrew this, you have a thing underneath, and you pour the oil in, and then you go, you want as little ambivalence, as little shadows, as little poetry or metaphor. Because we just want it to be a single entendre. It's just one thing that's being said. And that is possible. And it is really those things that make the greatest art. Because the more singular it becomes, then it's only about one thing. And I then think of those books which are the great stories, like the difference in my mind between Lord of the Rings and C.S. Lewis's Narnia series, where C.S. Lewis is an avowed Christian and has some extraordinary, wonderful things to say about Christianity and everything. But Aslan is Jesus. And in George Orwell's 1984, it is about the, is it the Bolshevik Revolution? I can't remember now, but it's like, it's, and this is this, and this, and the pigs are these.
Right.
And to me, not knowing or knowing that somehow makes that thing less than, because then you can say there is a right and a wrong way to understand this. And the more you want to sort of didactically tell them something, you get into the, into a manual or into the teacher who want to tell you how the geometry of a triangle or how to solve an equation. And then we're in this sort of, when it's single entendre and everything is this, but that, I don't think that is the sphere of art or whatever. I think the fact that it is open-ended, the fact that we like stories and that we remember stories so easily, but we don't remember strings of numbers like pi very easily. We understand things through story and we do all that. So that's the nature of what we then are showing. And the reason why I use it as use the poem as it, because in the poem, that's just what's being shown in the moment when I'm curating the time and attention. You could describe, you could say a poem, you could juggle, because juggling is also abstract and it could reveal stuff to you. We have a tendency when we watch abstract images move, if a triangle and a circle, and there's a famous example of this, and the triangle is standing in one way and there's a ball that goes up and a square keeps bumping into it. And people think it's like, oh, the ball is trying to roll up that hill and the square is knocking it away. Or like they make up these stories and then they all of a sudden can remember this, all this stuff that's going on, because now there's a story in here. But if you just try to imagine remembering the random movements of a fly in a room, you can't, it went this way, that way, up there, and then after a while you go, I can't remember what it did. But if it was, it flew towards the flowers, that, but then it got scared from the thing and then it went right, all of a sudden you can remember that thing. So there's natural sort of story in it, and then they're putting the poem at the center of it, so that you could do that with juggling too. You go, oh, it's the red ball that's chasing the other one, and all right. Of a sudden they can. That's not a good example, but you know what I mean. To just So the poem in the middle is being shown, and it has within it the fact that it, but that a poem becomes a classic, or that a text, or that a piece of art, a work of art becomes enduring through times, that there are certain books that you read now and you go, I can't believe that this is still connecting to me now. It's 200 years old. Why is it like this, or whatever? And I think that it does that because what they have crafted, and the reason why I talk about books and stuff and poems and that is because they're concrete things that I can share like now, but I can't share a performance in the same way or whatever.
Right. Yeah. But,
And the book, then you can share part of it, and you can get it through music, I guess, with notation. But it is that whatever this text is, it affords me truth. Because truth to me is not the truth, at least that it is about, that art is about, and the truth that we are presenting and sharing with people is not a thing. It's not 2 + 2 = 4. The truth that we are sharing is something that happens. The authenticity that we spoke about last time is something that happens. It's the experience that we have with the audience that this was authentic, because you can have an authentic experience when Hamlet talks about his dead father or whatever. You can have a genuine connection to it, even though it never actually happened in real life like that. This thing might express a human truth on a more deeper level. And how you connect to that will be subtly different from everyone. And the works which are exhausted after their first reading, because they are like a text, a newspaper, it's printed on crappy paper because it's supposed to be thrown out. It's just what happened that day and whatever. Like it's not. But the enduring things that goes on in our lives, they are the stuff that continues. And myths are like the perfect example of that. They're these boiled down patterns or structures or stories that when you read it today, it seems to be speaking about your situation today. You go, how could they know about Narcissus and echo his of how Narcissus is all in this thing, and he, the woman who's his nymph who's looking after him is the echo who can only say things that other have said. So she's echoing back to him the things he said. And there's a wonderful book, a Norwegian book, about this woman wrote about this myth, and she parallels it with social media. And you go, oh, like, then the myth of Narcissus and Echo and the guy who looks in the pond and falls in love with his own reflection and has Echo as his lover on the side, just repeating back what he says or repeating back. It's like, this is the picture of the echo chamber of the social media, but it is an ancient Greek myth, and it was about something else, but it's also just about itself. But what we find then are perennial patterns that continue to occur, and we continue to find truth in it throughout human existence. So that's what I mean with that. The myth there was not exhausted when everyone had in 1856, when everyone had written about that myth. It hadn't exhausted itself because social media hadn't been invented yet. So when I read that text now, and it just blows my mind when this woman is laying out and the details of the myth and continue to go, and it's like, oh, but it keeps fitting. And then, oh my God, it was because she had been, Echo had been unfaithful, and she had been talking all the time at Narcissus's wife, and so that the wife wouldn't pay attention that Narcissus was having an affair. So someone was just talking bullshit at her, and the punishment was that she would only not be able to say, just blabber on and not have any content. She would only get to be repeat what other people said. So you look at all these interesting details within the myth as a sort of a package of information and of story of something that you can connect to. So that's the kind of idea of how a thing will, when everything has been exhausted through the performance of it that we've created or whatever, and every book has been written, somebody comes 100 years later and just shows how this myth is still alive now. And that is the nature of the performance. And it is still also then, that's what you hope that your art will be, that you can continue to do it for this person or for that person. And to know, you can also face the other way and do a lecture. That's also a relationship to have with the audience. A teacher or a professor, when she steps up in front of the class and talks about the myth, or she talks about algebra, is also a showman sharing in this relationship. And she's after conveying more specific things, perhaps, because you want to take this thing away. And there are things that are real and that actually happened. And there are, but how we view those things and how that sort of open. So even in that classroom, when somebody says, it's like, oh, and then Narcissus did this, and then Echo did that, if we just take that as the example, then the different students in there will perhaps be triggered by all the bad behavior of these gods or whatever it was that they did. Or then people might be connecting it to something from their own life, or they're connecting it. So truth is happening in what she is saying, the professor, but it's also finding a way into each of them. Some of them will go, this is boring, I just need these things so I can get my degree and do the other thing I want. And some people will find endless amounts of stuff in it. So I'm trying to set that, like, that's the sort of multiplicity of meaning, or in great art, that it is not just one thing. It's not just that singular thing. It's something which is expansive, and that there is room for them to live themselves into and to connect it to their own life. And that's what I talked about last time with you. It's like, that's what depth is. Depth is interconnectedness. It has to do with how things correlate with other things, how they pictorially correlate, how they directly correlate, where they came from, and so that's what a thing, something you do, a poem, and that poem can be told through juggling, for instance. Or when I'm delivering texts, and this is the last thing I say, and I used to do the cans, I still do the cans. But then there was a time when I was made a solo show back in 2006, and I had so many more ideas of what specifically is going on when I say follow your dreams and that little speech that I do. And I decided to try to make those things more explicit. And it only happened in the previews or whatever, because by making it more specific what it was that I wanted to say, I made it less allegorical, less metaphorical, less possible to be that something that people would live themselves into and feel deeply to themselves, because I'm making it more specifically than just about me, and I'm narrowing it down, going, it's not this, it's not this, what I say is this. And when you narrow it down like that, which is why, like, well, as soon as I start working in text, then I am making it less than when you are developing your all the crazy pictures that you create, and with the juggling the balls and the flying VHS tape and the fan, and like, where you go, there's so much room for me to come into yours. And the back end of that is that they sometimes go, there's so much room in there that I don't know what to do with it. And in my performance, it sometimes can be that when I first start doing a piece, I am so concrete about what it is that I am doing that there is no room for them to live themselves in and to fully go. It just becomes me delivering, here's something I thought, you deal with it. Like,
yeah, I mean, this idea that the poem or these things mean different things to everybody, then it, again, I think it could be potentially intimidating to someone who's like, but wait, we were just talking that we have to know what kind of experience we're going to give people. And now all of a sudden I have to, I don't think about the audience as a collective one, but I have to think about each individual. Of course, that's impossible. And it comes to mind a funny story I have to tell you. Ivar Heckscher had a really fun idea, like concept for a show, because he was really into this idea of doing things that are not only appropriate for the audience, but things that are necessary. He always talks about necessity and says, what does the audience need to see today? And of course, that begs the question, well, needs in what way? Like, to what end? Or like, what are we trying to solve here? What are we trying to fix? But he had this proposition for me. He said, you know, what you should do is you go to a town and you read the newspaper from front to back every single day. You go to the same cafe where everybody eats, and you eat that food with them, and you sit with them. And so not only are you physically there, but you're, of course, talking to them and making small talk. And then so you kind of embed yourself in this community as the performer, I don't know, for like a month before the show. And then in his mind, he says, you know, then you go to do the show and all of those things just come out through you, and you do the one thing that's necessary in the moment for those people that's needed. And it's such a funny, impossible, you know, dream.
But it's beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, it's a kind of powerful, right? This idea, it's like such a nice fantasy that that touches on all these things you were talking about.
But it's, and I find that also, like, In one way, I'm going like, oh, totally, that is amazing. Like, you can really give them what's needed. But what also is like almost like the shortcut or whatever to that as well is to go in and you do those things, but maybe you only do it on the day that you're there, and you settle and you look at the paper and you read the whatever, like, you get. And then you might be able to find which archetype, which poem, which myth is it that's necessary for, hey, what is it that's going on in your thing? And that's what, where you sort of have the wisdom or whatever, where you can go, oh, you are interested in, like, the fortune teller, is it sex, money, love, or whatever, I can't remember, there's a few sort of key that is what, when you come in to talk to someone about what to do with your life, or a psychologist, it's the same situation. There are a few different things that you wonder about. Who am I? Or like identity, or like there's a few, and it's not endless. So then you can, with relative short, without being there for 1 year and tell the one story that they need to do, or show the one juggling trick that they need to release themselves into nirvana.
Right.
It's like to find that right, to find the bigger pictures. And that's what sort of art does. It's you look at Munch's Scream, and it seemed to just capture a whole, like, the angst and existentialistic angst of the 19th century, 18th century, like it, like 1800s. I mean, like or turn of the 1900s. It's like the new world, or like, and then you get this one picture, and then you can take that, and then you can tune into something bigger.
Well, I mean, Ivar's story reminded me too of this this thing that you do, and you know, many performers do, in a more commercial way. But you know, if you have a corporate event, like you said, you know, you get there early, you go hang out when you're loading in, you kind of talk to the people. Oh, what's the boss's, what's the CEO's name? Oh, where did you guys have any sort of special trip that you did recently? And then in your show, I mean, this is totally the hallmark of the really good professional corporate entertainers, right? Is that you're up there doing your bit, but then you drop the name of the CEO at the right time, or you kind of make a call back to that fishing trip last week, and the audience is like, yeah, you're talking our language, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it means, it's also subtle things like that. Even if you're like, it can feel really cheesy, but if you present it in the right way, just like, it just shows that you are aware of their situation, and now my relationship to them sort of changes. Right. They know that, yeah. I don't know the full extent of it, because they know that I wasn't there.
Right.
But they don't know which stories I have heard or whatever. So there's like going, I have in a miniature way embedded myself into their situation. And at the time when you saw me, that you vaguely referencing here, when I did that in Norway, it's also, there was just like an organization that I kind of know a bit about. It's like the people who make all the tracks that goes through the forest and all that sort of stuff. And I knew that they just built, all these pensioners had renovated a house in the forest that now is open for anyone to come and visit or whatever. So I knew what that organization was doing. So I could just drop those things and the development and give a round of applause for those people who had finished doing that. And all that. And it just created this perfect sort of atmosphere where I was from this town and I knew about this project, and there was a lot of people from out of town who'd come to be there. And I just knowing those things and saying it just created this real sort of intimate kind of vibe at a pace that I was almost not expecting. Like, it felt so jovial and so, like, even though there was however many people in there, 300 people in that room, and just it just had this real sort of intimacy that we know each other here. And then I pulled the guy out to do the whip thing with him, and everyone's like, ah, it's this guy. And I knew a little bit about that. And then all of a sudden it feels like, a little bit like it says in the poem, a showman is someone who faces the other way, someone who has walked with the crowd, but then turned around to face the others. Because I am no different than any of them. On a human level, I have the same worries and the thoughts as them. I'm nothing special. I've just focused on this one thing, and I spend a lot of time thinking about what is the experience when I turn around, and then I ask for their attention. And when that comes, it's my task, because that's the next line of the poem. I turn around to face the others, and I call for attention. And when I get the attention, I have something to show. It's like, that's not the words of the poem, but that's what it is. And what is it that I then have? Once you have the attention, it's all baked into that experience of it. And if they feel like I have just been walking with them, and then I turn around to share it, we have this level of intimacy that might be, on one level, it is, I don't know what exactly you guys did today in those lectures and the talks and the walks in the forest that you guys did, but I know what it's like to do those things. And on that level, I am now making truth happen here between us, even though the details of it wasn't fully true or whatever.
I mean, what you just said there and articulated, I have to say, I think a lot of people are searching for today, in the way of, I mean, in the circles that I'm hanging out in, for better or worse, in the way that, you know, people talk about maybe circus from the past, it's about being superhuman. It's about being superlative, right? It's not about being one of the audience. You're not the same. You're a superhero. You have a superpower. And what you're talking about is the opposite of that. You're saying, hey, we're the same here. I mean, yeah, you do different things than they do. You have different skills, but you're relatable, and you're a human being like they're a human being. You have a connection there. And you know, you hear a lot about that today in contemporary circus. people saying that, like, we want to go away from the sensational or spectacular as if it's like a cheap, you know, kind of cheating or inauthentic kind of presentation, and that people are looking for this kind of authenticity and this idea that performers are also humans, and we're not, especially since the pandemic. In the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about sustainability and performing in many different ways. And one of the ways was this idea of being vulnerable and having weaknesses and saying, hey, I can't do my triple backflip without proper pay and time to warm up and good lights and all these conditions that circus performers as a community kind of often overcome because we're used to fixing the situation, right? We're not like the orchestra where we have, oh, it's 5 o'clock and the bell rang, so we put our instruments down in the middle of the song because it's the union, you know, or we're on the clock, and like it's all these protections for artists. And then, because of course, when the pandemic came, we all had to examine what we were doing, and a lot of the governments wanted an examination of the field so that they could kind of quantify the economic damage. So a lot of these conversations started to happen that weren't really formalized before. And then you start to say, oh, yeah, well, actually, as a circus performer, I'm often asked to do what would be considered superhuman things in terms of like working conditions in relationship to the techniques and the skills that they're presenting. Right. I mean, how many shows have you done, Frodo, where you show up and you can't see, you know, the lights don't work for whatever you're doing, but you do it anyway. You do the trick anyway. You balance the spoon, you catch it on your ear, and you do it anyway. Even you can't see the balance properly. And that's like such a bigger, you know, metaphor for this tenacity that circus people kind of usually have. And so I think in contemporary circus, at least the discussions I hear a lot, is like people are kind of wanting to reject that idea of like that I'm I don't say better than the audience, but that we are on an elevated level in some way, that we are presenting ourselves to the audience as something that's more than and different than, instead of saying, no, we're all the same here. Like, I'm the same as you. We're all humans and we can relate to each other in that way. And now that we have this relationship, hey, check out this cool thing I want to show you, right? So I think what you just, like, you articulated that thing that a lot of people are searching for in the contemporary circus communities that I hang out in, at least.
Because to me, it's like, it's yet again, both of those things are true, because you can absolutely present yourself as more than and different than and whatever. And it's like the ballet star that's just like out of this world or whatever. You're going, I am just like you. But then they go out and they dance and you go, no, we are not the same. Or you go out and you juggle the seven balls or whatever. And it's like, presented in the right way, they go, no, we are not the same, because you have this ability. But so in one way you can go, it is also true that we are different, but all of those things are always true. It's like every human being is completely different. And I've dealt with this in one of the previous episodes, and they're gone. Like, it's the snowflake that's falling down and it goes, I'm unique, nobody is like me. And that's true, but it is also just snow. And it's like every human being is an individual in every single way. And I mentioned last time Ian McGilchrist as one of the thought people, and then Steiner, but it's also Henri Bergson, a French philosopher who talks about this. That everything is always different. It's like even when you go back and you do your act the next time, you are different and the audience will be different, quite literally. Right. Your previous experiences will have changed you, so you can now express other things or whatever. And the snowflake that falls down, it's true that it is absolutely individual and nothing has ever been like it in the history of the world, but it is also snow. So the different scales that we look at, you can present yourself as absolutely astounding superhumans, and that's what's great as well. Like, you can do that. It can be like the, when somebody comes out on stage and you really get the feeling like a superstar is coming out there or whatever. And some caught that and they do their magic show and they have a very large fake Rolex, and they have all of the clothes, and they have the Gucci stuff on, because some people find that important, even though you know that you might, when we saw a show here in Vegas, I'm not going to talk about what it was, but that aspect was permeating all the way through it, and it's like it I don't know how this person could stay alive or stay open there, because there was it must be hemorrhaging money. But giving that illusion of success and of that they're rich and whatever. And my friend Nick told me that, oh, they made a sort of TV kind of thing online, and to do that, they sort of rented a mansion to appear like they have a particular. So you cultivate that superstar thing, and I guess that's what we're talking about here, where we have talked a lot about kind of folk circus that you and Eric bring up in the first episode, I think, of your second season with on Object episodes, your podcast, I like that aspect of it. And I think, maybe it's a whole Scandinavian thing, that the Scandinavian contemporary circus scene is pulled a little bit in this direction of the what do you want to call it, genuine encounters or something like, or
authentic. Yeah, you're probably right. I think it also comes down to this idea that, you know, this academification, is that a word? I just made it a word, of circus, you know, over the past few years. They're looking for this idea of expression because they're comparing themselves to other art forms, and they're using these words from other places, and they're saying, yeah, but we're expressing ourselves. And I think in terms of expressing yourself, you want to relate to that. And then when you present yourself as the human cannonball, and you have the motorcycle helmet on, and you have all the sparkly shirt and or whatever you're wearing, that's really hard to relate to on a really personal level. I mean, you know, you're presenting that as this iconic image. You're trading on the cultural value of that image and all these preconceptions we have of how to experience that. But then when you want to start talking about art and being expressive and expressing yourself, I think it does come down to this idea that you want to be vulnerable, you want to be human, you want to humanize what you're doing. I'm not saying I have a player in this game, or I don't care either way. I'm not in this fight or whatever, but I do think that you articulated a bunch of things now that people are struggling to, that they're searching for. And that, so I think it's really valuable what you said. I just want to put this as a highlight or a marker of what you're saying, because I think a lot of people are searching for those words that you just said. And you said it very well. So I appreciate that. Do you want to do one more snip, or are you?
Yeah, no, let's do, we can do one more for sure.
Okay. It's a doozy.
Okay, good. Because there was a second part to that last one too. What was that again? I can't remember. Have I even?
No, but you already did it. You kind of did it on your first pass at it.
Yeah.
The second part was just that. That the poem will be more than the sum of all those experienced truths. And I think that's really nice.
Like going, that was what I meant when, I think her name is Linga, and the woman who talked about the myth of Narcissus and all that, that all of a sudden now that myth becomes so unbelievably relevant. And it was, you can't say that the situation with social media was anywhere near the minds of the creators of the myths. But those myths are what they are because it also encompasses our situation now.
Right.
So that the unintended meaning, never intended or not made for that, but it is speaking to a deeper pattern than the confusion of the 10,000 things. Like it's about a pattern that you go, oh, this happens all the time. This thing is a recurring thing, and that's like, yeah, so that's why how I tried to cover that.
Well, now we're going to get into Henry Corbin.
Oh, okay. Interesting that I pointed him out too, though, then, because okay, yeah. Oh, okay, so, we're going, this is like a whole nother episode then, actually, and we're talking about the imaginal and stuff. Yeah,
well, I mean, this is still in my episode 2 notes.
I mean, and just in terms of me talking about it, because
So I have a little snip about you talking about Henry Corbin, and I'd like to read the snip.
Yeah.
And then I have a pretty specific specific request from you after I read
that's
it.
Good,
so
we should try to limit it because that's such a big sort of
exactly.
And
and we're not going to go to outer space here. We're going to go the opposite. We're going to go back. We're going to go back home. We're going to go to the donut shop and look at the fly, the dead flies on the countertops. Okay.
Okay. I am there.
Okay. But Henry Corbin goes on one step further in his use of this word. For him, the imaginal realm is where spiritual realities can be accessed through visionary experience, where abstract concepts can take on real corporeal meaning. And in this sense, it's the realm where we experience meaning, where depth and essence, like we experience their meaning, and depth and essence, the depth and essence of the material world. It's like, sorry, this is AI. I'm always struggling through this AI. I never clean up my transcript. It's like things just are, but we understand them and understand their depth and essence and meaning in this realm.
Yep.
And Henry Corbin insisted that the imaginal was real, even more real or more fundamental than the physical realm. So, okay, let me give a context here and a really specific request. I'm not familiar with Henry Corbin.
No.
I'm a native English speaker. I can understand these words that I just read. And I think I can kind of understand, like I can literally comprehend meaning from them.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm looking for is a simplification or a more pedestrian use of language.
Yeah.
If you can uncover a couple of things. And so one of the, there's two parts to what I read that I find most fascinating. I'll just point those out.
Cool.
One is, it's where abstract concepts can take on real corporeal meaning. I think that's freaking cool. But unpack that with real language. And the second one is, then Henry Corbin insisted that the imaginal was real, even more real or more fundamental than the physical realm. I mean, that's also freaking, that's crazy. That's in outer space. That's on Mars, man.
Yeah, yeah. So Henry Corbin does, I have not this specific information, but I watched a course by, I think he's a New Zealand professor, and he has a channel on YouTube called Absurd Being, and there's a 20 plus episode where he talks about, so it's like 25 hours or whatever, where he talks about the philosophy of Henri Corbin, and it's super fascinating. He didn't talk so much about the imaginal, because Corbin was a philosopher and all that, but he was also a student of Islamic mysticism and of Islam. So he has, and the imaginal that he talks about here is something that apparently then comes out a bit from that, and it's well on the edge of what I can do. So
we already have our first grounding here that the AI makes me say Henry Corbin in my great American way instead of Henri Corbin.
Yeah, but I don't know how to say it either, because I also read Henry Corbin. That's also his name. So whatever. I actually, in the episode as well, I realized that I have read so much and heard it, but I'm saying it.
No, it's just also the AI transcript is hilarious, how it just like bulldozes over any nuance.
Yeah, it's great. But then, so, and just the last one, I did that little summary just before we started talking about Henri Corbin, and that I said the myth of Narcissus is actually a story about a continually repeating pattern or event that happens. So that Narcissus and the fact that his lover or whatever, or the one that unfulfilled in love, because you can only forever be unfulfilled or in unrequited love with somebody who is a narcissist, because they actually love themselves and you love them, but you're echoing the words like that stuff there that sounds like it's about social media. It wasn't that. And the reason why this thing remains true And a Corban would sort of say that the reason why it's true is because it is talking about the imaginal realm, the realm which has the patterns that are bigger than the individual whatever happens. When these things will happen again and again, because he believes that the world is kind of, it's a thing which is a process that's always unfolding, which is why he thinks that every time you sing the same song, it's kind of coming into being again, and it is a new thing in the world, because it has with it all the, it's always changed. You have your memory that, not, so it moves in. So he said, saying there are patterns in this, all of it, that keep occurring again and again. And I mean, I can't, he speaks of a lot more of this. So that's why I'm also using this dense language, because I'm trying to say a whole lot with very few words.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's talking, he's in the kind of same realm that Carl Jung is about, with that there are archetypes here. And I'm starting to believe that the showman is an archetype, and that we can understand what they do in the world, and this is a way of, a whole way of being in the world. So when he says that, it's like, it's, and so the specific, because if I were told the story of Narcissus, but it could be told through a particular person and what happened to them. They fell in love with themselves, and they were in an echo chamber, and then they did all the stuff, and it was so. And then it takes on, you know, he would say that's an instantiation of the imaginal. It's a manifestation of that pattern, and it's now become corporeally real. It's a real thing that actually happened in the world. It's not just that myth reminds me of that, but you can point to a situation where you go, that myth just happened there. And that right. happens around the world all the time, in a way.
Mm.
So this realm is here, and then he then thinks that, and that's why, and that he comes out of religious kind of thinking or whatever as well. But it is that there is this other level to reality of greater patterns of things that happen. So. And the reason why he then says that that is more real, it's also connected to Plato's idea of forms. It's like each individual rabbit is just an instantiation of the idea of rabbit. Because you can cut the legs off and the ears off, and it still remains a rabbit, and they can be totally deformed, and there can be all sorts of changes. But the idea of rabbit, each rabbit will be imperfect, but the idea of rabbit is its own thing. So in that way, it's a little bit like how Plato talks about the world of ideas, the world forms. And it is that a real thing in itself, which is kind of what Plato did. So in is it Raphael's painting where the school of Athens, where Plato in the painting points upwards. He's got his hand in a gesture that points upwards. And Aristotle, who's standing next to him, is pointing into the world. Because to Aristotle, the what the rabbit is or what the chair is something that we get from 1,000 chairs in our world. We then get the idea of the chair. And Plato kind of goes, it's the idea of the chair, and the chairs, every individual chair is a one instantiation of the idea of the chair or whatever. So, and Corban is the, and then in his talk about the imaginal and real, I think I've linked to a on the website, no, on the show notes, if you go in and there's a link there that you can click on, and I was supposed to have done it, so you can go and read one of his essays on the imaginal, but it is a little bit hard to understand, but I just kind of thought that it is important to bring this in here, that some of the stuff that we do, and that poetry and some of these things, they are kind of the fact that you create an artwork that remains valid and interesting to people, and that gives people great experiences, that you can hear a poem again and again and all that, that is because it is tapping into something which is more universal. It's greater than the sum of the details. So that's why I'm also like, I can't remember if I say, but I think I say, so Corban thinks that this might actually be real, and there's religious people who believe that this is actually the real world with the angels and all that, and us is just Maya, that it's the grand illusion of existence, which both Hindus and Buddhists, I guess, talk about that. It's like but the real truth is something deeper or whatever. I don't know if I subscribe to that, but this imaginal realm, I think this is what happens when when I stand in front of an audience and they are giving me their time and attention. When this relationship comes to its full conclusion or its full fruition, then we are being pulled into a different way of being in the world. Now the show comes into being. It stops being just me and the audience. A third way of being, they're watching me in a particular way and I'm delivering material. And in this way, like whether I'm just delivering jokes and they're just fully engulfed in Mad Apple in Las Vegas and one thing goes to the next and it feels like a hole for them, that experience, that could be seen in my mind as an imaginal experience. It's we have taken part of something which is grander. We are many watching the one or whatever, and the experience of what the show actually is of that different dimension. And in that dimension, that's where a story comes alive. It's why the Gilgamesh epic is still alive now. Why Beowulf, the story of the hero that goes to the underworld and fails to gain wisdom or whatever. And the stories, it's where religious ideas comes out. And we go, so Jesus, he broke the bread and the fishes. And going, yeah, in one way, it is just about the guy that there were some fishes and some bread. But in another way, we also go, it is about something more. And that's something more that brings billions of people together around these ideas. That is the truths that we talk about that are more important than the specific details that you can talk about through 1,000 years, and they continue to give people great depth and meaning, regardless of what the validity of whether we think it's real or not. I don't get into that, but that realm,
yeah,
that is the realm that we are tapping into when we're making this shared time and attention together, and we listen to each other in this kind of way that we do. And it's a very, very grand way of looking at somebody who makes balloon animals, or somebody who juggles, or somebody who does magic tricks. But what I want to do with this whole season and the whole what the podcast is to go away from that thing of going, oh, it's just entertainment, or it's just this.
Yeah.
There's nothing just about what we do. It's not near anything. It has the potential to be everything. And if you step out onto the stage and you truly have taken these things in, that this is what I do when I go out there, even though I'm only looking for the laughter when I'm going out in this specific thing. I'm not talking about perennial human patterns of betrayal or whatever. Like, you still go out and you take in a small part. You in a small way, you take part of this grander way of interacting with human beings, not just sit down over there, don't stand on my hand, but actually when you're telling the story, it's about something all the much more that I get when I read a poem every now and then, and you feel like, oh, or even when you take psychedelic drugs, then you go, all of a sudden you see patterns and you see ways of being in the world that is like, oh, now I understand. I was confused by the details and now I see what it's really all about. I need to quit my job and move to the country.
Mm, right.
I don't know. So it's hard to put the imaginal into simple language.
Yeah.
It has to do, I think, in a way that it's, because when we talk about these things, we don't need to believe in anything super sensible or extraterrestrial or supernatural, because we have all taken part in these experiences that are in some small or large way transcendent of what happens during a show when people come up afterwards and going, oh my God, and they don't have language to express it. And it was so joyful. And somehow they feel like wherever they go, it was such a, and they come after the show and then they go and they feel like going, when you did that joke and it was like this, they when they say that, then you have this feeling like, but it wasn't just that joke. It was this, it was the way this was connected. And then she came out afterwards and did that thing, and it gave me this emotion. And it was like the hole becomes so big that they can't express it anymore, because it was everything everywhere all the time.
Right.
And you might have fallen into that imaginal kind of space of experiencing reality. Jeepers. I'm aware that this.
Hey, good job on that, man. No, that was, I appreciated that. I didn't know how you were going to tackle it. I think you did good there. So thanks for, spending some time to talk about that some more. And we're going to see that imaginal realm coming up more and more, I guess, in the next episodes anyway.
I mean, this episode, actually, the one that I think have just come out, I talk a little bit more about this, the emergence of a show. Which you start with the showman and the audience, and then what the show is. And I go back to something that I find almost comical, but the picture of the triangle. So some of you might already have listened to this and be a little bit ahead of time, but it shows this extra dimension of when two points, the relationship with an audience, and it starts as two points. But then once those two points meet each other, you sort of go, actually, now it's not just your showman, it's not just the audience, it's something that is the both of them. They're both now paying attention, and it's a give and take that keeps happening. And you sort of go, that thing now is not just on the line, it needs to be a separate thing. The show has come into being. And once you do that, you move that one point off, you get a triangle, and it goes from having no area to actually having an area. And that's like, I'm sort of going, we're now in this other dimension, and when we leave each other, that area disappears, and we take the experience of it with us. And so I do good. That episode is sort of more specifically about what showmanship and stuff is. And I am talking about the imaginal in episode 2 of showmanship and play, because we are looking for what is the inner air of showmanship. What
exactly,
is
yeah.
The same thing that was started out in the ancient times, and that we are still now taking part of. And we already know it. I'm going to lead towards the activity of play and what that is as a way of being in the world. And that thing that comes into being there is this space of a particular way of interacting with each other, which I think is there in rudiment in certain animals, maybe, but it is a purely human way to experience the world.
Yeah, and I really like how you come upon your imaginal realm as the inner ear that you're going to use as your metric through this journey. And then that's why I thought that this Henry Corbin stuff is a little bit of a sidetrack. Not irrelevant, but it's because you put a nice context on your arrival at that as your metric. It's really cool.
So it is totally true. And when I was writing this, I was also wondering whether there was room in this thing. And I felt like maybe I put a little bit too many words into this imaginal kind of thing. But it's yet again me who, as when I spoke to Lucian, this guy about him was like going, well, a lot of the time when I'm writing and talking and whatever, I make all the examples from somewhere else, from other people or whatever. Right. Maybe it's
I liked the Henry Corbin stuff because it gives the depth and credibility of this imaginal realm, man. It's freaking crazy. So it's heavy stuff in the best of ways.
Stuff. And that's what I also want to continually sort of do, because I see so much in what we do. And that doesn't mean, like, when I'm seeing go and see a magic show here and it falls flat of those things. Those things aren't coming to fruition, but I see them as possibles there. And that's why I see what a preacher does, or what a good priest can do, or what a rabbi can do for their congregation when they stand in front of them. Or you see it in the Pentecostal thing here, or in the people who drink poison and get bitten by rattlesnakes or whatever. Like all the, like, this is also one facing the other way, and they're in that sort of domain, and we are not doing exactly that, but it is part of that same human thing. Corbin might have thought some of these things were totally real. Other religious people think they're completely real. I look at them in a slightly different way as supremely valuable, but I don't know about them as, truth happens in many different ways, and it might not happen in that specific religious direction for me, be it the the Islamic one that Quran is coming out of, or the religious, or the Christian one, which is more familiar to myself because I grew up in Norway, which is kind of a Protestant kind of place and Western thinking or whatever. But so there are interesting, huge, huge patterns that a lot of people find a lot of meaning and value in. And I do think in a very, very small, but potentially as big as you make it, we're in this realm. And that's what season 5 or 6, whatever, it's going to be about, the relationship with the shaman and the kind of religious possible roots of this. But that's not what we're exploring here, because in this season, we're talking about play as the root of, as we shall see, all of those things as well. So the connection together here between play and that is definitely like boiling out, and it is this different realm that comes from a particular way of being in the world and being in relation to each other, whether that is a lion cub, and because all mammals play in this way and they create this space for each other. So that's what we're going to develop as we go on.
Great. I'm ready.
That was a long one.
Yeah, man, I'm
much to say.
No, it was great. I'm I gotta go to bed. I got shows in the morning.
Oh, jeepers.
Yeah
All right, bro,
thanks for hanging out, thanks for saying all that stuff. I really appreciate it. That was super fun to hear what you think about these things. It's like a luxury to be able to have cool. That time to talk to you.
So nice. All right, man. Until next time. Looking forward to it.
See you soon. Thanks, Frodo.
Bye.
Take care.